Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And today we're going to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by once a month. Usually she comes by the second Tuesday of the month. So in August, just to let you know, she'll be on August 12th. But here she is today to talk about your pet's health. And one of the things we want to take up is food and what you feed your pet. You know, it's whether it's if you got a small dog or a big cat or an old one or a young one, they all need good nutrition, don't they?
They do. And, you know, it's overwhelming. I have a new puppy now and trying to find a diet that he likes, that I like, it's overwhelming. If I'm overwhelmed going into the pet store, I can imagine what it's like for pet owners. Yeah. But one of the big kind of fads right now is the whole grain-free diet fad.
Right.
And I think it makes sense for cats because cats are true carnivores, but it doesn't mean that grains can't be part of their diet if they have to be cooked, obviously, because they do offer a good source of nutrition. They offer some, obviously carbohydrates, some protein, vitamins, and fatty acids and so on. So it's part of the balanced diet. But I think it's really almost follows the human craze for gluten-free. I mean, the other day I saw a gluten-free beer and I'm like, oh, come on, you know, but that's like, I think the pet world is kind of following that same human craze. And we do see one breed of dog that has gluten intolerance, and it's, again, a very uncommon problem, but it happens in Irish setters. But that's been the only dog it's ever been diagnosed in is in the Irish setter. But the big reason, what I hear, is people think that it's going to be helpful for their dog if they have allergies or food allergies. And actually, the grains fall very low on that scale of what causes allergies. I mean, we know that the animal protein is probably the big thing that ends up causing most of the allergies that we see. So don't fool yourself thinking that a grain-free diet is going to solve your dog's allergies or food allergy problems. And, you know, it doesn't mean that they're carb-free either. I mean, people are like, I want to feed a real high-protein diet to my dog, and so I want it to be a low, you know, a low-carb diet, so I'm going to go with the grain-free. Anything that's dry has to have some carbohydrate in there to hold it together. And actually, some of the carbohydrate sources, like potatoes and things that they use, are less digestible than the grains
What grains do they use, by the way?
Typically we're looking at corn. I mean, in the grain-free diet, okay, they're using other sources of carbohydrates, right, like sweet potatoes and yucca and different things like that. But, you know, when you're looking at digestibility, they are not any more digestible than the grain diets that have like corn and wheat and so on like that in it, as long as it's processed. And, you know, and I think that, you know, again, back to this, like the whole high protein thing, there's certain things our body can store, like fats and so on. But protein's one of those things where we have no way of storing extra protein. So it makes for some pretty expensive urine. And, I get people coming in complaining about their lawns turning yellow. Well, it's because of all those extra nitrates that your dog's urinating out because you're feeding them maybe too much protein that their body can't handle. So, you know, if you want to go with one of these diets, just go in realizing that you may be paying a lot for something that may be no better than some of the other diets that are out there.
So how do you have some recommendations for comparing the different ones and choosing the right one?
My number one recommendation, regardless of what you're looking for, is these diets should be, have gone through AFCO, American Association of Feed Control Official Diet Trials. And you want to actually see that it's gone through these trials. Many of the foods are just based on a recipe. And so if it says formulated to meet AFCO standards, they may have never fed that dog or that food to an animal. They just are able to make it. And now we're starting to see some issues with they formulate it, but unless they're going through feeding trials, you may miss out on some of these nutrient deficiencies and things that we're now seeing in some of these other foods. So it's best to stay with the big companies that do the testing. That's going to be your safest bet.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, great to have her along. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Joe in Watertown has a question for you. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, quick question. I have a cat. He's probably about 5 years old. And I actually had two cats for a while. I just recently got rid of one because he had some sort of health problem. And now my cat, who has always been kind of a meower, is really going crazy at night.
Okay, so he's by himself now at night?
Yeah, he's by himself. And it seems like here's the one thing about it. It seems like if we have a full bowl of food for him, it has to be completely full.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty much fine.
Okay.
But if his bowl of food is down in any sort of way,
yeah,
he gets completely crazy. So I'm not sure if it's the food, if it's the cat missing. I just don't know what's bothering him.
And it may be a combination of those things. If your cat was older, I mean, sometimes we'll see elderly cats that have cognitive decline, like senility, and they may be more vocal at night. They're wandering and getting lost. They have changes in their sleep-wake cycle. Sometimes we'll see cats that are hyperthyroid, that are more vocal as well. But the cat that's 5 years of age, very unlikely that there's a medical reason for this. It sounds like it's all behavioral. And all it takes is him meowing a little bit. And if you get up and serve his needs, give him some attention, even if it's not the best attention, like you say, you know, tell him to be quiet or whatever, he's still got somebody there paying attention to him. So the key to dealing with this is, you know, try to, you know, and pick a time when you can be sleep deprived for a few days, but just do not get up and you know, respond to his meowing. Just, you know, it will eventually extinguish. But if he starts meowing and meows louder, trying to get your attention, and that's when you get up, you've just shaped that behavior to be more obnoxious. So you want to try to ignore it as much as you can. I'm a big believer in like automatic feeders that you can set to go off at a certain time so he can anticipate when food's going to arrive. The fact that, and I hear this all the time about cats, that if the food or the water dish is totally full, they're fine. But once it gets down, they don't want to eat from it. It may have something to do with their whiskers coming in contact, or I don't know, you know, who knows what it is, but you may want to experiment with different forms of things that you can put his food in, like putting it on a cookie sheet or something that has smaller sides to see if that maybe makes him get through the night. I'd hate to use food, though, as the way to keep him quiet, because you're going to end up with a fat cat that could turn into a diabetic or have arthritis and all these other things going on too.
Okay.
So, you know, that's kind of a tough situation, but, you know, getting another cat's a huge commitment. So don't just jump into doing that unless you're absolutely ready.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Joe. Appreciate it. I want to give Pat in Elm Grove a chance to join us. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have an 8-year-old Shih Tzu who's went blind one weekend completely. I had noticed that the whites in his eyes had turned red, and this was in March. And so we ended up at the eye ophthalmologist for dogs, and she thought it was a tumor, but put him on antibiotics, and in 3 days he was seeing again. And I was just wondering if you've ever encountered this before.
Well, what I'm concerned about is there's a couple of things. One, we can see inflammation inside the eye. It's called uveitis, okay, anterior uveitis, that can produce enough changes that it can interfere with vision at some points if you've got enough like flocculent material floating around in there or whatever. So the fact that it responded to treatment, I don't know if they, you know, if they gave you any, you know, advice as to perhaps what was causing this. Often when you have a dog with inflammation inside their eye, you really have to jump through a lot of hoops to try to find some answers, looking at fungal testing and parasitic evaluation and, you know, checking blood pressure and you know, for things like toxoplasmosis and all kinds of things that you can evaluate. And sometimes it just comes down to, we don't know what causes it, but we'll treat it. And many of these dogs will get better. The problem is it can recur. So I'm making the assumption that that may be what was going on since it did respond to treatment. Things like cataracts are not going to go away. There's other conditions that we can see in especially in small breed dogs. There's called SARD, sudden acquired retinal degeneration, where they go acutely blind in a day or two, and but they don't get better with that either. So count your blessings. Your dog did get better, but I'd be making sure that you go back in for follow-up appointments to make sure that you don't have any underlying issues still going on there.
Yeah. He had told us on the initial testing that his eyes were in perfect shape, that she felt there was something pressing on the optic nerve.
Okay. And so if that's the case, you know, then you're looking at maybe a visit with a neurologist, you know, having other diagnostic work done, you know, looking at the pituitary gland and maybe getting an MRI done of the brain. You know, so there's a whole path that you can go down. I'm very happy that your dog is better, but this sounds like quite the oddball case to, you know, but you did the right thing. You went to a specialist and got some answers, and now, you know, your dog's better. But I don't have any other answers for you. I don't know why it responded to antibiotics. That would be odd if it was a tumor or something like that.
Pat, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Another issue that I think that comes up a lot is with cats is when there is a litter box problem. Be very stressful and expensive situation. I can raise hand and say, yeah, I know all about that. How common is it that a cat has, that there are litter box problems?
It's very common. About one cat out of four will quit using the litter box at some point in their life. And it may be due to medical problems. It could be behavior problems. And the reason why I bring this up is that this is one of the most common things that I just get asked. It's like, oh, by the way, as an owner's walking out the door, or I'm in the hallway at work and another colleague or somebody comes up to me and they say, my cat's not using the litter box. What can I do? Well, the American Association of Feline Practitioners just came out with a 19-page suggested things that we should be looking at and doing. So a quick answer in the hallway isn't usually going to be helpful. These can sometimes be pretty difficult cases to figure out. You know, you have to rule out medical problems. You need to look at the social situation in the house, the resources that are in the house, the human management of the problem, and putting all of this together to try to come up with some answers. But it can be frustrating, and it may not be some real quick answers. But I do suggest that anybody that has a cat with a problem may want to go to the AAFP's website and just, you know, Google American Association of Feline Practitioners, and they do have those guidelines for diagnosing and solving house soiling behaviors in cats. And I think it's a really good read and an eye-opener for a lot of owners.
Are there one or two things that are not immediately apparent?
From what I find is if it's a behavior problem where it's just the cat doesn't like the litter box, probably the number one thing is not enough litter boxes in the house, or the litter box isn't big enough. I just reviewed an article looking at litter box size where they provided cats with a quote-unquote jumbo litter box that you can buy at pet stores, uncovered, obviously, and then also provided them with, you know, other things as well that they could use, like cement mixing trays and so on. And what they found is that the cats, the bigger the better. The cats can move in it better. It's kind of like us in a porta potty or in a really tiny bathroom. It's like hard to move around in. Cats like to have that room to move. And so I may pardon the pun, but I like to think outside the box when it comes to buying a litter box and using things like sweater storage bins. We want to try to have something that's at least, if we can, about 38 inches long and equal, you know, if we can get it equally as wide, obviously most things are going to be rectangular. But I love cement mixing trays. You can buy them for $3 or $4 at the, you know, big box home improvement stores. So they're inexpensive, they're sturdy, and they're easy to clean, and cats like them.
Yeah. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're taking a look at how to keep your pet happy and healthy with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Irvin Brown Deer, been waiting a while. Thank you for waiting. Hello.
Good morning. We have two dogs in our house, and we just rescued a third dog 3 weeks ago. It's approximately 18 months old. It never had any shots or anything, so the first thing we did was took it to the vet and got its shots. But after about a week, it developed a bad cough, sneezes, stiff up white phlegm, the dog really does this during any activity in the house. And I take his, all three dogs for walks outside for 20-minute walks. It doesn't do this.
Huh.
I took it to the vet, and the first thing she prescribed was Clavamox 62.5 milligram. Took it for, gave it for 6 days, no improvement. Took the dog and got doxycycline, Hydate, 50 milligrams. Taken that for 6 days. Slight improvement now. The doctor now has prescribed Tamaryl tea.
Okay.
And I'm very concerned because it has prednisone, which has so many bad side effects. Our house has only linoleum, wood, tile floors, no carpets. We do not use air fresheners. The only carpet is runners in the kitchen and the bathroom rugs.
Any smokers in the home?
No.
No smokers. Okay. Yeah. Because that can be irritating for dogs as well. This is really interesting.
And the other two dogs have not gotten the cough.
Okay. You know, the fact that they're sneezing and coughing, and your veterinarian thought that it was potentially an infectious type problem, my guess is that they were treating for kennel cough, which is, you know, kennel cough is one of those things where there's a whole host of things that can cause it, from things like adenovirus and actually Bordetella bronchiseptica, which is a bacteria. There's some herpes viruses and even things like dog influenza can cause coughing and sneezing and fever. I have not diagnosed a dog with influenza myself, but there's certain areas of the country where it is becoming more prevalent for dogs to be able to pick up this particular type of bug. So the fact that he didn't respond to antibiotics, and the doxycycline is fairly effective against Bordetella, then, you know, is this a viral type problem? Is this an allergy to something in the house, even though you don't have anything that you would think would be causing allergies? Things like house dust mites and different molds and things potentially could cause a problem. Before you start jumping into using, you know, something, the Tamaryl P, which is a prednisone-based, very low dose of prednisone medication, have you done chest x-rays or anything like that yet?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't done
that. I'd be looking at, since this was a stray and we don't know anything about this dog, I'd be making sure it's heartworm negative. I'd be making sure that you probably consider getting a chest x-ray. Going to the next level for coughing would usually involve doing bronchial alveolar lavage, where they actually flush some fluid down in the airway so they can look at the material that's coming up. And that sometimes is helpful to rule out infectious problems or allergic problems. You'll look for certain types of cells, which may be helpful. But I think the easiest thing would be to go back to your vet and say, let's get a chest x-ray done so that we can look at what the airways look like and if there's any problem that way. I have to assume with the doses of drugs that you were using that this is a pretty tiny dog. It's not very big.
Yeah, she's 12 pounds. She's poodle and gazelle.
Yeah, and sometimes we will have things that are anatomical that can cause coughing where it isn't infectious, things like a collapsing or a weak trachea in these little guys. And maybe when she's in the house, if she's really playing with the other dogs, that may trigger a cough, versus when she's outside, if you're using a harness or something, may not be a problem. So, but I think we need to go back to the drawing board and try to actually get a diagnosis before we just start throwing medication at the dog.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You mentioned Bordetella, and I there was some question about what are the guidelines for whether a pet, your pet needs a Bordetella?
Yeah, the American Animal Hospital Association's vaccine guidelines for dogs does not include Bordetella vaccine on its list of what we call core vaccines, ones that every dog needs. But when you start looking at how dogs pick up kennel cough, which again can be viral, bacterial, and so on, most of the kennel cough vaccines we use are going to be directed towards Bordetella bronchiseptica, which is like our Bordetella pertussis or our whooping cough, in the same class of bacteria. But there are, like I said, lots of other causes for this too. And some of the causes are included in the distemper parvo vaccination that your dog is getting as well. But kind of my guidelines for who needs it, it's not just dogs that go to kennels, but it's going to doggy daycares, going to dog parks, taking your dog to the big box pet food store where it can go in and wander around and shop with you, where you're going to be meeting random dogs. No one is there checking vaccination status. And these bugs are spread through aerosol. I mean, coughing, and dogs don't know how to cover their mouth up, and so they may cough on the other dog. But it can also be oral from contact with toys and things like that that the dog may be putting in its mouth. You know, I think when you start looking at it, many, many dogs fit in those categories where they should be getting it. And it's an annual vaccine. It doesn't provide good long-term immunity. In really high-risk dogs, you may even want to consider doing it a little more frequently. There's three ways you can give the vaccine. One is nasal, drops in the nose. The other is oral, which works very similarly to the nasal vaccine. And then there's an injectable form, which really doesn't work at all. It's very poorly effective, and so we don't recommend using it. But the only time I would use it would be a dog that we need to show proof. I mean, this sounds horrible, but that they've been vaccinated so they can get in a kennel. And because that's all it's providing them with is a piece of paper that said they've been vaccinated. Oh, it doesn't really provide much help. So, yeah, it's one of those diseases where, you know, you really, bring up the dog's lifestyle with your veterinarian if they're not asking.
Jamie and Holman, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have a young cat who was recently diagnosed with a mild case of pancreatitis. So I'm wondering what the best way, understanding that it can be a chronic issue, what the best way to increase our odds of not having to deal with that again. Mm-hmm. Right now she's just on a mild, so an ID brand diet. So yeah. I don't know. I've read some stuff on enzymes, that kind of thing. So I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, well, the pancreas actually has a number of different functions in the body. It does produce enzymes for digesting food. And when the pancreas becomes repeatedly inflamed, that production may be affected. The pancreas also helps with regulating blood sugar through manufacturing glucose, kind of a totally different part of the pancreas. But when we see pancreatitis or inflammation of the pancreas, cats can present with a whole host of different signs. Some of them are very mild to quite severe. It can be sometimes a very chronic type thing, versus in dogs where they're usually in critical care being managed. Cats typically don't go down that path. But you're doing the right thing with a low-fat diet. That's probably the best thing you can do, is maintaining your cat on a low-fat diet and being careful that, you know, you're a good label reader. You know, cat foods tend to be generally higher in fat than dog foods are. I'm not saying use dog food, because obviously it's not balanced for a cat and there's actually deficiencies in there. But you may be looking at having your cat on a therapeutic diet like, you know, ID or EN. There's several of them on the market that the different pet food companies make to prevent having a problem again happening. So that would probably be your best bet.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Reed in Clintonville, thank you for waiting, and let's get you on the air. Hi, Reed.
Oh, yes. This is so opportunistic. Thank you, or serendipitous. our old boy, Max, a cat, went in this morning for cleaning of his teeth. And the young woman behind the counter tried very aggressively to get us to purchase an anti-sedate injection. In other words, you know, he's sedated to have his teeth cleaned. And then she said, well, you should buy this this anti-sedation medication. We'll inject him, and he'll come out of the sedation much quicker. Well, pardon me, we just felt that as old as he is, he doesn't need another injection of any medication of that sort. Plus, I'd rather have him be sedated a little longer so he's not wide awake in a cage overnight.
Right, right.
And so I just wanted to hear a comment from you on that.
Well,
and I'll do is I'll hang up and I'll listen on the radio.
That sounds great. A couple things I'm just a little concerned about. You said the word sedation. The problem with either doing conscious or just sedated dentistry is that the cat's going to, if they're just sedated, have their swallowing ability impaired. And so it's you can't, under just sedation, get an endotracheal tube in for them to breathe through. And so you may end up having them inhale some of the, either the cleaning fluid, if they're ultrasonically cleaning the teeth, or chunks of the tartar, or anything else that's coming off blood, so on, depending on the severity of the dental disease. So I think what we're looking at is, if they're doing sedated dentistry, I'd be running to a different clinic. I mean, I think anesthesia, although people, you know, think, oh, sedation is going to be so much easier on the cat, anesthesia is actually a safer way to do that important dental cleaning. So I'm hoping that your cat is actually anesthetized on oxygen, on fluids during the procedure to make sure that the, you know, kidneys and everything are kept functioning normally, since it's an older animal. The drug that they're probably talking about is, there's a part of the anesthetic protocol that we do is we'll often use a little sedation to begin with so that we can get an IV catheter in, get them ready to be able to be fully anesthetized and have a tube put in. And the name of the drug is called Dexdomitor. We use it probably more in dogs than we do in cats, but there is a reversal agent for it that does wake them up a little bit more. If your cat does have significant dental problems, I'm hoping that the veterinarian is going to be doing some local blocks. They usually will use, just like us, where they put in local anesthetic, they use one that's going to last a little bit longer than ours, whereas when we leave the dentist, we may have a numb mouth for a couple of hours. There are other types of local anesthetics that you can inject and do nerve blocks that are going to last longer to help provide pain relief. We also like to provide pain relief afterwards, too. And I don't think keeping your cat in an anesthetized or sedated state for a prolonged period of time is going to help control any postoperative pain. I really think that addressing the pain through proper pain medication is going to be better for the cat than letting them be in a sedated state much longer. So few things coming up here. I'd have to talk to the clinic to find out exactly what they're doing. But, don't think that the use of the reversal agent is going to be problematic for the cat. It's probably going to be beneficial, and that the cat will wake up faster, start having their normal organ function faster, breathing on their own faster, get their body temperature up faster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So call them back and say, yeah, I'll take the reversal.
All right. There we go. Scott at La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. That this is about hip dysplasia on my sister-in-law's dog. It's a 6-year-old lab mix, and they've been looking into different options. A hip replacement, they really don't want to put the money into that. So the veterinarian is talking about removing the ball and socket, and then I'm just wondering if this is something that could have a good income.
It really depends on the weight of the dog. The bigger the dog, that particular surgery called ephemeral head and neck osteectomy, where the hip joint is a ball and socket joint. If you were to do that to us, our legs would end up in our armpits. But because dogs walk at a right angle, it ends up going up into the muscle belly. So the leg's going to be a little bit shorter, and they form a false joint. It can be very effective in smaller to medium-sized dogs. Bigger dogs, it's not as effective. And so, if this is, a lab mix and it's a big dog, you're going to be looking at other ways of controlling pain, such as a daily medication with anti-inflammatories or other types of medication to control the pain, like tramadol. Maybe weight loss if the dog has a weight problem, physical therapy, using other forms of exercise like swimming, supportive type things like that may be very helpful. Acupuncture may be helpful as well. So there's a lot of different things like that you can do, including even things like joint supplements and joint-specific diets. It's going to buy the dog a lot of time. But eventually, you know, if the dog becomes arthritic enough, you may be looking at doing things like getting like a ramp to get in and out of the house, a ramp to get in and out of the car, things like a help them up harness to help the dog stand up and lay down again. So there are things like that that can be done. But I'd really have to know a little bit more about the dog before I can make a comment on the surgery. It can be successful, but definitely not for big dogs.
Yep, there you go. Good luck, Scott. Heidi in Oak Creek, hello to you.
Hi, I love this show.
Thank you.
My question is about a possible adverse reaction to a flea preventative. Mm-hmm. I have a 14-year-old pug, and in the past we've used Frontline Plus. And I decided to try Canine Advantix 2 this year because it also repels mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 hours after we applied this to him, he became extremely restless. He wouldn't lie down more than 1 or 2 minutes. And I was afraid that he was having an allergic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Although his skin never got red, and it didn't seem to be his skin didn't seem to be bothering him.
But he was uncomfortable.
He was very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and there's a condition that we see. One of the active ingredients in Advantix 2 is permethrin, which is a synthetic pyrethrin. And when it's used at appropriate doses on dogs only, very toxic for cats, it can be very safe. Although there is a population of dogs, typically, I'd have to say it's probably, in my experience, has been kind of like the little white dogs, the Bichons, the Westies, and so on. I don't know why, but I just see more of those have this kind of reaction. And it's called permethrin hypersensitivity. You put it on, and within an hour or two, they're twitching, they may roll a lot, they're really uncomfortable. And we don't know whether it's a nerve hypersensitivity because, like you said, the skin looks normal. But the best thing you can do is bathe them, use a good, you know, like I'd even probably use a little bit of, you know, a gentle like shampoo or even like if it's like greasy spot, maybe a little, you know, dish soap or something like that just to get that material off. And go back to using something that does not have permethrin in it. Even though you want that mosquito repellency, you're not going to get that with Frontline, but I think that your dog may be one of these ones that has this hypersensitivity to that particular chemical.
Yeah.
I did give him 5 milliliters of Benadryl, and it helped tremendously.
Okay. And whether that was because of its sedating effect of Benadryl or, you know, it did help with, you know, histamine release in the skin. Usually if Benadryl is going to be helpful, you're going to be seeing some skin changes. That's why it helps. But you're not seeing that. So, but again, I think just for your dog's peace and your peace of mind, switching back to something that you might be a little more comfortable with and your dog will be more comfortable with.
There you go. Thank
you. Very
much. Yeah, thanks, Heidi. Mary Jo emailed us, my husband and I are traveling to Florida this week with our Australian Shepherd. I'm concerned about keeping our dog cool in the heat and humidity of the Florida panhandle. Also, the effects of the dog lapping up the Gulf salt water.
One, don't let them drink the salt water. Always travel with your own supply of regular water because that's going to make them sick. You have to be the dog's brains when it's really hot out. I mean, making sure that they're, especially if it's a pale-skinned dog, and a lot of times dogs that, like Australian Shepherds, can have a lot of pink on their nose or their belly, they can get sunburned very, very easily. And so looking at using a safe pet's sunblock on your dog. Don't forget, it's not just the nose that we get concerned about. A lot of dogs like to go out and sunbathe and kind of flip their belly up and cook in the sun. And we do see a lot of sun reactions in the groin area. So make sure you put on sunblock in that area as well. Obviously, don't use anything with zinc in it because dogs may lick that and that zinc toxicity. Although it's not that severe, it when it's like an oral product like that, it can make dogs vomit and upset the stomach. So be careful with that. But, you know, it's a matter of, you know, air conditioning. They do make things for dogs that are like bandanas that you can soak down or collars that have the water-absorbing beads in it that will keep it nice and moist for a while that may help the dog. But it comes down to you have to be the dog's brains and make sure that they limit their exercise to morning and evening.
There you go. We have Candace and Nina who has a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Candace.
Hi. Thanks for talking with me. I have a female 8-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel that has a really severe dry eye condition in both eyes, and we've been treating this for at least a year and a half or more, and we're to the point where they're talking about possibly moving a gland from her mouth to her eye, and I'm wondering what you know or think about that procedure.
Yeah. What is she currently being treated with?
Oh, my gosh. We have had so many things. Right now, she got a real severe infection in both eyes. So we've got a antibiotic eye drop, and then we have
tacrolimus, yeah.
Yeah, we have that right now, those two. We've had the one that they usually use.
Cyclosporine, yeah. It's a cyclosporine, yeah.
We used that for a long time.
Did it help?
Nothing helps for very long.
Okay.
And she doesn't have, like, one drop of... they just did the test where they put the paper in.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't have one drop of you know, fluid in either eye.
And she was currently on one of those immune suppressive drugs, the tacrolimus or cyclosporine, when that was checked?
Yes.
Oh, she was. Okay. Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just really, really severe. We're just not... in her. It's so dry, like her nose... I have to take a Q-tip and clean her nose out because there's no moisture.
Oh,
anywhere.
Poor thing.
Boy,
oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
It's really, and she's healthy and she eats and she plays.
Yeah.
And she has this horrible eye thing.
And it's painful. It can be very painful.
It is.
You know, besides using medication like the tacrolimus or cyclosporine, which in the human world, there's a product that people may have seen ads for called Restasis. We just use a dog version of that. We still have to use artificial tears and artificial tear gels pretty much all the time, so that you've got that, you know, good gooey, you know, protective gel. And I know that our ophthalmologist likes one of the over-the-counter products for people is called Genteel Gel Extreme, and that's been found to be pretty helpful. But again, it's a management problem. You can't be gone for, you know, 8-10 hours without having something put in the eye. So it does become a problem. Before these other drugs came on the market and the majority of dogs do respond to those drugs, obviously your dog isn't very well. I don't know how long the tacrolimus has been on board, but I, you know, definitely don't give up on it. But we used to do this, what's called a parotid duct transposition. We would take one of the salivary ducts that would dump saliva in the mouth and relocate it up to the eye. And basically what would happen is you'd show your dog a dog biscuit and they would cry because the tears would flow down and the saliva would pour into the eye. And so it's going to give some moisture, but there's different minerals and things in the saliva that can build up and can sometimes cause some problems. I mean, it is major surgery. You're working around a lot of facial nerves and things, too. So there's some, you know, potential for some pretty serious complications. I would do everything in your power to try to have this dog on, you know, consistent artificial tear gels and being treated for infections. I mean, you're going to become best friends with your veterinarian and your veterinary ophthalmologist.
Oh, no, we are. It's a full-time job doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have not seen this surgery done for years. I mean, it was something that was talked about in the 70s when I went to vet school. But that I've never seen a dog that's had this done. I've just heard about it. So it would be kind of an oddball thing to get started doing. So I think twice. But if the ophthalmologist is saying that's our last resort, then obviously go with the pro make sure that you know all the different side effects and so on that can occur.
Yeah, keep us up to date. We'd like to hear how things turn out for you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller and really happy to have with us today Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. You may have a health issue relating to your cat or your dog. I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And an email from Mark in Green Bay, whose 4.5-year-old German short-haired pointer recently had a checkup, and the vet expressed her and anal glands and suggested we bring her back monthly for the same procedure. At the time, she was not indicating any abnormal excretion behavior. Can you explain whether or not this would be necessary?
Yeah, you know, anal glands are one of those things, or anal sacs are a normal thing for dogs, and they usually empty when they have a bowel movement. Often when I am doing a rectal exam on a dog, I will, you know, we happen to see that, you know, if, even if the dog is asymptomatic, if the glands are there and they're big, I may express them to look at the contents to make sure that things look normal. But, you know, to go back on a monthly basis, unless they were seeing some issue like the material was really thick or it was infected, I would hope that if that's the case, then they'd be treating the infection. But I, you know, if the dog's not showing any symptoms and everything else is normal, it doesn't necessarily need to be done, because mm-hmm. it's, you know, many dogs go for their entire life without ever having to have their anal glands expressed. Some dogs have to have it done frequently. Some even have to have them removed because there's such a problem for the dog. But I'd be really questioning why go back every month.
Kathy emailed us and wondered about her 2-year-old GSP dog.
German short-haired pointer. Yeah.
Had a great holiday weekend chasing the kids around while they played ball. We think that while running on the pavement, she took a layer of skin off her pads. She's licking at them and some limping. What can we do to help that? Should we put antibiotic neosporin on her pads? Bitter apple spray?
Well, we need to keep her away from them. And so that may mean wearing one of those cone of shame. So, okay, to protect the feet so the dog can't get at them. Obviously, be very careful with the surfaces that you walk your dog on. Imagine if you had ulcerated areas on your feet or your hands and you were constantly having contact with things. You may want to look at using some of the protective booties and things that dogs, that they make for dogs. Although many people use them in the winter, they do serve a purpose in the summer. I've even, when I used to work at a dog camp in northern Wisconsin near Stevens Point, where there was a lot of sand. And so we get these dogs that have not had, you know, toughened up pads, and they go up there for a week of running around on the beach and stuff. And they would get really severe pad irritation. We handed out baby socks, little kids' socks, and we would just put those on the dog. And sometimes that was very helpful for them, but it usually meant a change in what they were allowed to do. So Neosporin won't hurt, but just don't let the dog lick it off.
Jerry in Appleton, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have 2 dogs, and you had a vet on one time that advocated a vasectomy for the male dogs, mm-hmm. and I really like that idea, but I've called around all over, and I can't find anyone that does it. Is there a reason? Can you help me with this?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I've only, in my career, had 2 patients that the owner has requested to have the dogs have a vasectomy done. They wanted to keep them virile, but just not able to reproduce. And so that was what was done. And we do this at the veterinary school. It's a fairly simple procedure, but it's done under general anesthesia. The things that you would have to realize is that if you are doing this for birth control, that's one thing. But if your dog has some male-related behaviors, then that are obnoxious, leg lifting in the house, fighting with other boy dogs, running away to chase after the ladies, that's going to persist. You know, and there is a lot of controversy in the veterinary world about neutering, and whether it should be done, when it should be done. And, you know, and so there's still a lot of stuff going on looking at orthopedic issues that may be more prevalent in dogs that are, you know, spayed or neutered when they're really young, different forms of cancer. We do know that spayed and neutered dogs do live longer. They just die of other things than dogs that are left intact. But it's, you know, it's very controversial. controversial. And I, as a veterinarian, this is something I've never done. We are not taught how to do this, but it would be something that if you call the veterinary school, I'm sure that would be something that you can make arrangements to have done.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I will do that. Thank you for your help.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Heather in Madison. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have an 8-year-old English bulldog, and we recently switched him from just a regular Purina dog chow to a lamb and rice formula to try and clear up some tear staining issues. And since then, he's developed a rash on his stomach that he sort of licks, and it's red and then gets infected and pussy. And I'm not sure what to do. We put him on Benadryl and Zyrtec, and we've, you know, been giving him oatmeal baths to try and soothe the itching, but nothing seems to be curing it up.
Yeah, he really needs to be seen by a veterinarian. My guess is that he probably has a secondary infection. I don't know what triggered this. You know, we do see, you know, sun irritation. We do see dogs that, you know, just if they're out running through tall grass, sometimes we'll get little lacerations and cuts, and it can trigger a skin infection. It's probably unrelated to the food. Where did you hear about switching to lamb and rice to help with tear staining?
I just read it somewhere online, and okay. I thought it would be worth a try.
Yeah. Well, good old Dr. Google.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, probably is not going to be doing anything, because the staining is a function of a chemical in the tears called porphyrins, and diet change is not going to really affect the porphyrin level in the tears. It's probably you're better off keeping the face clean and addressing the issues is why your dog is producing so much tears, whether they have extra eyelashes, skin folds that are rubbing on the eyes, eyelids that are rolling in that are causing some issues that way. That's what needs to be addressed. And I don't think the diet probably has anything to do with it. But if you're actually seeing pustules on the skin, your dog's screaming for antibiotics. And I think it's time to go into the vet and have the skin looked at. They would probably do cytology to determine what bugs are there. They may even be looking for other things like other parasites and things by doing some skin scrapings. And my guess is that you'll probably be going home with one of the common antibiotics we use for treating skin, like Clavamox Cephalexin, something like that.
There you go. Thank you very much, Heather, for calling. Barbara in Green Bay, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I hope I'm not beating the subject to death, but I've been on the internet and Dr. Google isn't helping me either. My dogs are 9-year-old Cavaliers. They are on a 2-ingredient dog food and have been most of their life. But I've heard Dr. Sosik say something about that you don't have to buy those expensive food for your dogs. I'm now retired and on a limited income. I'm paying $60 for 28 pounds. And so but the internet confuses me. When I put in the trials that you mentioned, all I get is raw dog food, and I don't want to feed them raw dog food.
Yeah.
It's probably more expensive.
Yeah, what you want to be looking for is the American Association of Feed Control Officials, AAFP, okay? Feed Control, AAFP. Feed Control Officials, yes. Oh, whatever. But AFCO, okay. AFCO is the... So have a look at that, and it should be on the bag. You're not going to probably find it listed online. You actually have to go and pick up the bag or go to the pet food website and actually look there, and they should be able to tell you should have that listed somewhere. It's usually in very small print. It's not going to be the easiest thing to find. When you say a 2-ingredient diet, can you tell me?
Yeah, it's potatoes and chicken, or I can get potatoes and fish, or I can get potatoes and buffalo.
But there has to be other things. Yeah, there's going to have to be other things in there, minerals and other things like that. So it can't be a 2-ingredient diet.
Well, it's considered that, and it's considered it's natural balance. Is
okay.
What it is.
Yeah, and you know what? A study that was just done looking at the over-the-counter limited ingredient diets like Natural Balance, what they found is that because they're not made in plants where they're totally cleaned out, kind of think of like peanut allergies in people. How often do you see things that say this product has been manufactured in a plant where peanuts were handled? That's what can happen. And when they started looking at these diets, they found all kinds of proteins in them. So don't fool yourself that you're feeding a limited ingredient diet. Unless it comes from your veterinarian as a therapeutic diet, you are not going to be feeding just a limited antigen diet.
So how do I choose? I mean, how do I find a food that's good for them?
I would work with your veterinarian. That would be your best bet because they know your dogs better than anything and they can come up with the right calories and so on to be able to get a diet. It's a very difficult decision and they're going to be your best source of material to be able to find the right diet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to have problems switching them to something that's a little more complicated as far as their diet?
You always want to switch slowly. You know, do a very slow switch. Yeah. Don't buy a big bag and do it slowly and watch for the stool consistency, flatulence, whether they like it, you know, anything like that. And just go about it slowly.
Okay.
Right.
Very good. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dan says, my eight-year-old German Shepherd has a diagnosed cyst on his back, which is drained. It was drained. We're traveling, and it's coming back. It's about the size of a grape. Online advice seems to suggest doing nothing about it.
Every time you put a needle in it, you can risk infection. So typically, if you want to get rid of them, you have to get rid of the cyst wall, which means surgically removing it. So I wouldn't do anything right now until you get home, then talk to your veterinarian about having it removed. So hopefully it's small enough that they can do it under local sedation.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Sandy. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. So happy to have you along. And Sandy Sawchuk, Dr. Sandy, so happy to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
We always have lots of questions and calls when you're on, and certainly today is no exception. A few photos, I didn't ask for them. I should have asked earlier. You got a great photo of your dog. I hope you'll post that on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Of course, you can always call in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. And we have Jilly in St. Croix, who's been waiting quite a while. So let's go to Jilly. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good day, and thank you. Doctor, this is regarding the grain allergy you spoke of at the beginning of the program.
Uh-huh.
I had a Bichon, and there was absolutely no doubt that this dog was allergic to grain. He had the hot spots. He was a rescue. The people I got him from had him tied outside for 4 years.
Uh-huh.
He would go in circles, and obviously you're familiar with the hot spot. He suffered and suffered. When I got him and put him on a grain-free diet, it went away within days. And within the year and a half that I was honored to have him, there was three, maybe four times that he got into food before we changed mm-hmm. the other dog. He got into his food, and each time he would go again into this suffering mode of where, you know, he'd pull his hair out till he had the circle, and once it was done, there was nothing the vet could do. He would just have to suffer through it. So I'm curious what
I'm not saying that grains are not allergy-free. They just happen to be much lower on the list. When there was a study done looking at 267 cases of dogs with diagnosed food allergies, which means that they went through the appropriate elimination diet trial using a therapeutic diet from the veterinarian that we know is going to have either hydrolyzed protein or a single very uncommonly fed protein source like kangaroo or venison, but maybe even in this state that could be fairly common. And what they found is that the number one ingredient that dogs were allergic to was beef, then dairy, then chicken, then wheat, egg, lamb, and corn, okay, in that order. And so, you know, when you really start looking at it, the protein in the food is going to be the number one thing. So I'm glad that you found the reason for your dog. It just would not be one of the first things I would be looking at. Mm-hmm. But when we are feeding a hypoallergenic diet, we're usually looking at the protein sources over the grain sources, just because when you're playing the odds, that's what the most dogs are going to be allergic to.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you for calling, Jilly. Miriam in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Hello. I love this program. I always learn so much.
Good.
I have a rescue Malamute. Her name is Mia. And I would like people to know that oftentimes Nordic dogs seem to have an intolerance for grains. Mia used to be able to clear out a house with absolute abandon until I found American premium dog food made right here in Cedarburg, Wisconsin. She does very well on fish and potato.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's one option. The other question I have is right now she's 9 or 10 years old. We're not really sure. And I give her a glucosamine chondroitin pill a day and 2 tabs of salmon oil because she has a ready dandruff. Is this an appropriate treatment? I'll sign off and I will listen to your answer.
Yeah, you know, it using for dogs with arthritis, using a fatty acid supplement that has balanced, you know, the balanced fatty acids may be helpful because that can help modify the inflammatory response, not only in the skin, but in the joints as well. A joint supplement that contains glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, although, you know, it's a lot of the information that's out there is just kind of hearsay. There's very little supportive research. I would say it's not going to hurt the dog. Go ahead and feel free to use it. And, you know, so that would be fine as well. But, you know, our big thing for controlling arthritis is making sure that we're maintaining that muscle mass so that the dog still needs some exercise, but you have to modify it, keeping them lean so that we make sure that they're not carrying extra pounds that are going to be causing the joints to be more uncomfortable. And then often we have to add in other forms of pain medication because the joint supplements themselves may not control the pain. And we're looking at quality of life in some of these older dogs. So often it comes down to using things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Be careful with using human medications. You want to use something that has been looked at for dogs because some of the products that they use in people, like ibuprofen, the therapeutic dose for dogs is very close to the toxic dose. And so work with your veterinarian and use that. And then other forms of pain relief using, you know, kind of non-traditional veterinary, like handing you a drug, would be things like acupuncture if the dog's or chiropractic care. I guess we have to call it spinal manipulative therapy. That's the appropriate term for it. If they've got some like back issues, maybe very helpful and be able to provide them with relief up until their senior years. Mm. So, yeah. So if your dog's happy, keep up the good work.
And Pat in Duluth?
Hi. I had to call in because I think I'm suffering all these same issues as the dogs. And I'm referring to the dry eye problem mm-hmm. that the woman called in about before. And I just saw my eye doctor about a month ago. And when I heard you say that the dog could take a human drop, like Restasis, I wanted to share the drops I bought at our local co-op, our food co-op. And they're made by a Swiss company, so they're available throughout the country, I believe, the United States. The brand name is Similasan, and the drops are called Dry Eye Relief. And I was to the point where when I would wake up at night, I could hardly open my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Within two, using these drops twice, there was a huge amount of relief, and I just can't highly recommend them enough.
Oh, good.
It
I'm glad.
Really, really, really helped me a lot.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the product, but I will definitely look into it and check with our ophthalmologist and just see, you know, if they know anything about it. But mm-hmm. I'm glad you were able to get some comfort. And you had mentioned that I said you could use Restasis in dogs. We don't use Restasis. Dogs have their own licensed product that we use.
Oh, okay.
But it's the same active ingredient that is in the human product. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. I guess I misunderstood.
I just don't want people to think that, you know, hey, my dog's eyes are a little irritated. I'm just going to pull out my own medication and put them in because that may not be the dog's problem. And we need to make sure that we've got it in the right concentration for the patient.
Yeah, I totally understand that. And these drops are homeopathic, too, so I just wanted to add that.
Okay. Well, I hope your eyes stay comfortable.
For your program.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Amanda in Minneapolis. Hi.
Hi there. We are traveling with our two pugs for the holiday, and we'll be gone for about a month. And we've noticed that our girl pug has been reverse sneezing the past day, maybe like 10 times. And they both done it before the cat, and it went away. And this time, it's making us a little nervous that she keeps doing it. And I was wondering what exactly a reverse sneeze is.
Yeah.
Well, anybody that wants to see, I used to, before the internet and so on, have to be able to demonstrate it on the air, but then I would
and
have...
And we're talking about a reverse sneeze here.
Sneeze, okay. Which is not a sneeze where you're expelling air. They're actually inhaling. And I'd say go to YouTube, you know, put in reverse sneeze and you'll see all kinds of dogs doing this. What it is actually happening is the soft palate, the back of the roof of their mouth, is getting caught up in their airway. And so once they swallow, usually everything flips back where it needs to be. But because your dog is a pug, they are blessed with usually an elongated soft palate to begin with, because everything's kind of pushed in with those smush-faced dogs. And so anything that can irritate that palate is going to make it bigger and meatier, and it's going to get caught up in the airway. And so sometimes it's dogs that are panting a lot, that they've got, you know, that their mouth is getting a little irritated or dry from all that air movement. Sometimes it's things like there's a nasal mite that can sometimes trigger this type of thing as well. Sometimes it's, you know, they've licked something like burdocks and caused some irritation. Other times it's just, hey, I'm excited and I'm breathing fast, and that's what's triggering this. Sometimes massaging their throat will get them to swallow, just gently rubbing their neck and their throat area, giving them something to, like, you know, giving them a treat or something that they can take in and swallow will often flip things back into their normal position. But if this becomes a debilitating problem for the dog, looking for some, you know, the underlying reason, often it means going in and doing a good oral exam while they're sedated or under anesthesia. And some of these dogs really need to have a soft palate resection to be able to lead a normal life. I'd say, you know, with the fact that it's occurring while you're traveling, my guess is it's probably just excitement. They're in the car. She's breathing fast. So try some of those things that I mentioned about massaging the neck, making her swallow. And as long as she's back to being normal again fairly quickly, I wouldn't get too worried about it.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Amanda, for calling. Irene in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call and about my Shih Tzu with the high blood alkaline phosphatase.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to you last month, and she's happily running around with that. But we have a lot of a special Hills prescription diet for hepatic health.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to ask you, do you think that diet is really necessary?
Well, there's so many reasons why that particular liver enzyme can be elevated. Alkaline phosphatase is just one of many things that we check when we're looking at liver health. And we can see it increased with sometimes medications that the dogs may be getting, especially drugs that are in the steroid line. Sometimes we'll see it elevated in dogs that have a condition called Cushing's disease, which is an overactive adrenal gland. Sometimes with gallbladder or the bile system in the liver, if that's inflamed, can cause it to be elevated. So, sometimes when we have just this one lab test, it's like, well, where do we go? Do we, you know, jump in and do some more liver function testing? Do we do an ultrasound to look at the liver and the gallbladder? And so there's different ways to be able to get a diagnosis. And sometimes we don't get one. We just have this dog with an elevated value that's perfectly normal. And I think if, you know, if your veterinarian has put all this out on the table, or if these are things that you could do. I just had a dog in today where exactly the same thing, where a month ago came in. We've been tracking this particular liver enzyme, alkaline phosphatase, and it's gotten up a little bit higher. I offered the ultrasound and so on, and they said, no, what we'd like to do is let's try the dog on a liver-sparing drug. There's one that we use. It's called Denimarin. It's a brand name. It's a milk thistle, SAMe-type product that helps with liver repair. But a liver diet would be another thing that would potentially you could try. What's special about liver diets is they tend to be a little bit lower in copper. They're slightly protein restricted since the liver is involved with dealing with nitrogenous waste to a degree. They do help if you've got a liver that's not functioning normally. But get them back in again after they've been on the diet and just see, has that value dropped? Well, little Jenny was just back in this morning, and I have not got the blood work back because I left to come and do the show. But we're going to see where she's at. If we haven't made any headway with just using a supplement, our next step is going to be jumping in with both feet and doing some other diagnostic work. So I think that would be fine.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling. I should mention, I just took a quick look here at my Facebook page, and there's a number of fun photos of happy-looking dogs.
Oh,
look at the
smile. Oh, my goodness. A real smiley dog, yeah.
Really smiley. I don't even know the breeds here.
Well, that looks like some type of like an Akita mix or something.
Yeah, black and white.
Yeah,
very
beautiful.
Here's somebody's
hard day of play. Yeah,
it's from Mindy, and Matthew sends one of their German Shepherd.
Oh, what a gorgeous picture! That needs to be framed and put on somebody's wall. That's beautiful.
That's beautiful. Oh, you see, there's even a goose in the background.
Oh,
that.
Very nice.
And then. A water spaniel, maybe?
No, that's like chocolate lab
that's
swimming. And I guess the family looks like they're out with a waterproof camera and getting action shots of the dogs swimming. But, you know, just seeing that picture, seeing the greenish hue to the water, that may just be the reflection of the trees. But we are in always algae watch, you know, and so blue-green algae is out there, and we need to be really careful. So inspect that water before you take your dog swimming and make sure that it's a healthy source of water for them to not only play in but drink.
And while we're on that water subject, I see we've got something from Rick, either maybe Facebook or email, wondering is it a problem if a dog eats a frog?
Typically not. I mean, toads will produce a really nasty tasting material that will make the dog drool and so on. I'd be more concerned about it being a big foreign body. You know, depending on the size of the dog and the size of the frog, they swallow that. It's a big chunk that eventually is going to get digested, but you've got bones, you've got the skin and so on, so it could cause some intestinal upset. So I would think trying to feed your dog something else and letting them go out and catch frogs. I mean, catching them, maybe, but try not to let them eat them.
Debbie on Facebook said, our vet gave our dog the shot to prevent kennel cough, and Sandy, you say that doesn't work. Should we take her back and get the one up her nose, and would it hurt to do this?
Yeah, the research that's been done on the injectable Bordetella is that it really does not provide good coverage. This is information that's coming from our immunology department at the veterinary school. I think that if your dog is at high risk, I would be making sure that your dog is vaccinated with either the intranasal vaccine or the oral Bordetella vaccine, which when we used to use the injectable, it was primarily for really feisty dogs that we couldn't get near their head. But now, even with the oral vaccine, they can be muzzled and we can still get it into a cheek pouch and no one gets hurt. So we have those options. There's the other two to use.
Carrie and Rhinelander, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a one-year-old golden retriever. He just turned one in May. And we had some company up over the holiday weekend along with some dog company. And he spent the entire portion of the day on Saturday swimming and playing with his dog friends, I guess you'll say. Sunday, he slept a lot. And we noticed in the evening when he kind of got up, he was really stiff. And then as of yesterday, he could barely walk. His right front paw, he was lifting. And just really sat on it the whole day. So I did a little bit of research. I have an appointment with his regular veterinarian on Wednesday. But is it possible to tell the difference between a possible ACL tear or just a simple strain in a dog?
Yeah, the anterior cruciate ligament in dogs, or cranial cruciate ligament, is involving the back leg, not the front. So if they're lame on the right front, that can't be a cruciate ligament because the cruciate exists in the knee on the dog's back leg. And what we look for when we're doing an evaluation for cruciate, there's a number of things that we put the dog through. We're looking for instability in that knee. When we have one of those crisscrossing ligaments rupture, the dog's leg is going to be unstable. And so the lower limb is going to be able to move independently of in the upper part of the limb. And so we look for what's called tibial thrust, anterior drawer sign, these are things that as a veterinarian we're just kind of doing on autopilot. But you could watch your veterinarian when they're doing this. You'll be able to see as they're palpating the joints, they're actually looking for instability. So I hope that that's not the case, that your dog is just exhausted and maybe just has sore feet or something from all the play if they were running on rocks and sand. But getting them in and having them checked out, I think, is your best bet. That sounds like a good idea.
Well, they have sore muscles. The first time I play golf every spring, then I'm kind of...
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And what you usually see, though, is that they're going to warm out of that. They may be a little stiff when they're laying, when they get up from a nap. And then as they move around a little bit, they get back to being normal again. But if this dog is really that down and out and depressed, I'd even be worried about things like Lyme disease. I mean, if they're in an area with lots of ticks, have we just got a case of Lyme arthritis going on? So taking your dog's temperature at home, not a bad idea. Rectal temperature is pretty easy to do.
Margot in Linksville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. Is dog food, can that be related to the fatty cysts? I have two dogs that they...
No. Lipomas are a very common benign tumor that dogs get, and people get them as well. And it's not a function of the fat in the food. It's not a function of obesity. It's just genetics, and we see them fairly commonly. Most of the time, it's just cosmetic. We don't do anything, but if they're in a spot like in an armpit or where a harness or something may sit, then sometimes we do have to remove them. But for the most part, it's just something that the dog lives with. And once they get one, it's not that it's spreading. It's just genetically they're prone to getting them. And we'll see dogs sometimes walking around with multiple lipomas all over their body. But don't assume that a new lump is a lipoma. My own dog had multiple lipomas. A new one popped up. And it was growing a little bit faster. I checked it out. It turned out to be a malignant tumor called a cutaneous hemangiosarcoma. And even with surgery and chemotherapy, he only lived about 6 months. So it was a very good 6 months. But, those are things you always want to get charted and have them checked.
And do they go with specific breeds?
No. It's just common in almost any dog as they get older.
Mm. Okay. My second question is, I have a Jack Russell Schnauzer mix, and she's always been kind of pica, and she'll eat, rabbit feces and
sounds everything. It sounds like she's a dog. And again, that's one of those things where you need to be outside with her, having her on a leash, so you can ensure that she's not getting into anything like cocoa bean mulch or, other things that may be outside that could be toxic or harmful to her intestinal tract. Rabbit droppings, not a big deal. It's just the gross-up factor.
And thanks for calling. Yes or no, garlic is a flea repellent?
Does not work. At all. In fact, if you're using it in dogs and they lick it off, it can be toxic. So don't use garlic.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back with us on August 12th, Tuesday, August 12th. She's with the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her with us. And thanks for listening in, and thanks for all your great questions. And I hope you'll stay tuned. We've got lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.